Hell is overflowing, and Satan is sending his dead to us. Why? Because when there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth.
Ladies and gentlemen, August Donnelly.
Folks, you're tuned into Full Frontal on CHRW 94.9 FM. I am August Donnelly, and I bid you a good day or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are. With me, as usual, is the one and only Full Frontal intern, the Medina from Regina, Barb. Barb, how are you?
I'm really, really cold.
Evidently so, because you're wearing a parka-like winter jacket, despite the fact that we're inside.
I'm longing for warm summer nights.
Yeah. Do you feel a Grease moment or a Grease song coming on?
You can be Sandy.
Yeah, you would make me Sandy, wouldn't you? Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I'm really excited about the show tonight. It's a show I've been looking forward to doing for a very long time for both yourselves and for myself, to be honest. It's okay to be selfish once in a while when you're a radio talk show host, when you get to interview the people that interest you. The guest tonight, folks, reminds me of why it's such a pleasure to do this show for you. He's a world-renowned author of 6 books, an anthropologist, and Harvard scholar who the Wall Street Journal once described as a real-life Indiana Jones. He's also the subject of the major Hollywood movie The Serpent and the Rainbow, directed by legendary filmmaker Wes Craven, whose works include A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Hills Have Eyes, and The Scream Trilogy, just to name a few. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest tonight, the legendary Dr. Wade Davis.
Very cool. I'm looking forward to what he has to say.
Absolutely. Dr. Davis is a proud Canadian, now living throughout the U.S. and in Canada. He travels back and forth depending upon where his studies and his endeavors find him. But he's a tremendously interesting individual, and we're going to get to speak to him in just a few moments here on the show. So stick around. You're not going to want to miss this one. In the meantime, something I haven't gotten down to in a while is the listener email. So I think it's just about time that I caught up on a little bit of the good, bad, or otherwise, as I try to do as often as I can. I think I'll stick to the format I've stuck with thus far. I'll read off one good email that I received and one perhaps critical or negative email. What do you think, Barb? Shall we see what the folks at large have to say? See what the masses are saying about August Donnelly these days?
Let's hear what the listeners have to say.
Now, this is a nice email. So we'll start off with that. It's always good to start off on a positive note. Doug from Toronto says, "Hey man, I just wanted to let you know that I listen to your show all the time, and I really like the variety of guests you have on the show too. Radio stations should have more content like what you do. Cheers." So that's pretty nice. I'd say it's a nice letter from Doug, or an email I should say. Thanks a lot, Doug. I appreciate the props.
And we'll definitely try to keep up the variety.
After all, Barb, variety is the spice of life. Bad email, or negative email. This is from somebody who felt so strongly about my show that they couldn't even put their whole name down. Not even their whole first name. I just got the initial M, like Mike or Michelle or...
Maybe it's Madonna.
Or Mongrel. I don't know what the initial M stands for. I don't know. Who knows? Anyway, this is the email I got from M in London. "I don't like your show at all. Neither do my friends." That's it. Straight, simple, to the point. "I don't like your show at all, neither do my friends." M from London. Anyway, something else we haven't done for a while and I wanted to do, and I never have the time. I always have such great guests and obliging people on the show that my 30 minutes just isn't enough. I could go on all day, as my loyal listeners know. This is a segment we've done before on the show that people seem to like. It's a little segment we like to call...
Classified information.
That's right, folks. It's classified information. These are classified ads that myself or Barb has found, whether it's online or in print or on a handbill, you know, stuck to a telephone pole downtown. These are just some funny ads that we've come across, and these are actually all from local publications or local media, pretty much within Ontario, kind of anywhere from Windsor up to Toronto. Anyway, the first one is from the Villa Santini restaurant. This was on their New Year's Eve menu. I found this a while back, and I just haven't got around to mentioning it. But I figured for $34.95, it's a pretty good deal, especially on New Year's Eve. One of the things the Villa Santini restaurant offered was a black anus steak with two stuffed shrimp.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, hey, it's not easy to get a black anus for $34.95 these days. It's usually far more expensive than that, I find. Not that I shop for anus that much.
But I know where you'll be going on New Year's Eve.
Well, only if they offer it again this year, Barb. The next ad that we came across was a Help Wanted ad. Advanced Employment Services and Waste Management are currently seeking laborers for early outdoor shits in Clare County. Positions start at $6.50 an hour, and you can contact them in advance at their 800 number. So once again, for $6.50 an hour, they're seeking laborers for early outdoor shits in Clare County. I think that one might be a typo.
I wonder if they would disqualify anyone from this position if they've only had experience with early indoor shits.
That's a good call. Or perhaps somebody who's a very regular individual, you know, their bowel schedule doesn't exactly permit for early outdoor activity. Anyway, this one is really interesting. This is from Don Mills, Ontario, just outside of Toronto. This is the God's honest truth, folks. This was printed in a Toronto area newspaper, and this is not a joke. I think it could be a joke, but the fact that it was actually printed was real. Anyway, it's Employment Wanted, Former Marijuana Smuggler. That's the headline. Former Marijuana Smuggler. Having successfully completed a 10-year sentence, incident-free, for importing 75 tons of marijuana into the United States, now 75 times 2,000 pounds per ton, that's 150,000 pounds of pot.
That's some good quick math there.
Well, thank you. Having successfully completed a 10-year sentence, incident-free, for importing 75 tons of marijuana into the United States, I am now seeking a legal and legitimate means to support myself and my family. Next heading is business experience. Owned and operated a successful fishing business, multi-vessel, one airplane, one island, and processing facility. Simultaneously owned and operated a fleet of tractor-trailer trucks conducting business in the western United States. During this time, I also co-owned and participated in the executive-level management of 120 people worldwide in a successful pot smuggling venture with revenues in excess of US $100 million annually. I took responsibility for my own actions and received a 10-year sentence in the United States, while others walked free for their cooperation. Attributes. I am an expert in all levels of security. I have extensive computer skills. I am personable, outgoing, well-educated, reliable, clean, and sober. I have spoken in schools to thousands of kids and parent groups over the past 10 years on the consequences of choice and received public recognition from the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, for community service. I am well-traveled and speak English, French, and Spanish. References available from friends, family, the U.S. District Attorney's Office, etc. And replies are to be directed to a post office box which shall remain nameless in Don Mills, Ontario.
Well, there's got to be something said for honesty.
Yeah, I guess there's the old saying, honest to a fault, for good reason. The next ad was from Dennett's Wharf on the waterfront. At Dennett's Wharf, they claim, "We will do your mom for nothing again and again on Mother's Day." So, depending upon how old your mother is, and I suppose how open-minded she is, maybe you should or should not take her down to Dennett's Wharf on Mother's Day, where they will do your mom for nothing again and again. You know, folks, these are ads I found in the newspaper. I'm not making this stuff up. Direct all angry mail to Dennett's and other such parties. One last one here, folks, that I got to read because I really got a kick out of this one. This was, again, a classified ad, although this one's from New York State, so it's a little bit further away, but this is for a solid oak funeral handmade casket in good condition. Truly a work of fine craftsmanship, has its own hand-rubbed beauty as the graining, and only used once. Affordable for everyone. I don't know about you, Barb, but when it comes my time to go or when my loved ones go, I think I'm probably going to use a brand new casket.
Yeah, but I thought you were trying to go green. And, saving the environment really puts the fun in funeral.
That's terrible. You can call Brad. He's in New York State. I'm not going to give out his phone number, though, because I'm imagining Brad's received all kinds of voicemail. But, yeah, only used once. It's not a bad deal. Anyway, folks, it's time to get down to the interview that I mentioned at the beginning of the show. We're joined by Dr. Wade Davis, anthropologist and scientist extraordinaire and man of the world. So let's get down to it. I think Wade's ready for us.
And we're joined by Dr. Wade Davis.
Wade, thanks very much for making some time for the show.
You bet, August.
Now, despite the significant fame and success you've experienced over the course of your career, there's always perhaps those who are unfamiliar with your work. To that end, could you perhaps give the listeners a brief background into your studies and how you arrived at your current station in life?
Well, August, I work as the explorer in residence of the National Geographic Society. I'm an anthropologist, and my mission is really to celebrate the wonder of culture around the world. I began as a young kid in British Columbia, fortunate enough to attend college in the East at Harvard University, and I fell into the orbit of a really remarkable plant explorer, Richard Evans Schultes, who is probably the greatest living Amazonian explorer. And under his kind of shadow, or in his shadow, I slipped off to South America at the age of 20 and spent a year and a half, eventually as an assistant to a really remarkable botanical project to study the ethnobotany and the origins and the botany of coca, the blind leaf of immortality, the notorious source of cocaine. And then I returned to work under Schultes as a graduate student and worked again in South America until the opportunity came up to, at his request, go to Haiti to seek an understanding of this very strange phenomenon called the Haitian zombie. And then one thing led to another, and really my mission today as an explorer in residence of society is to really draw attention to the fact that just as there's a sort of a biological web of life around the planet, so too is the cultural web of life, which is really humanity's great legacy. And just as the biosphere has been severely impacted by the loss of habitat and the concomitant loss of plant and animal life, so too is our own human legacy being impacted. You know, and so that's really my mission, is to draw attention to that.
Now, just to touch on a couple of things, Wade, if you don't mind, you mentioned you alluded to there, studying the botany of course, the various plant life in the Amazon River region of South America and in Haiti as well. From what I understand, you've come across various plant substances throughout your career that I suppose one could say makes more commonplace narcotics like marijuana look pretty tame.
Well, you know, our museum at Harvard was the world center for the study of medicinal, toxic, and hallucinogenic plants. And one of the things we were always trying to do, particularly in the early days, and long before people really had noticed the issue of tropical deforestation, was to try to suggest that the botanical realm had given us a great number of the drugs in our modern pharmacy, and that, you know, the old adage of the great Greek scholar Paracelsus, who said that the difference between a poison, a narcotic, and a medicine is simply dosage. In other words, plant explorers interested in research for the pharmaceutical industry aren't necessarily looking for a drug or a medicine used by a particular society to treat the same ailment that we could suffer from in our society. On the contrary, what you're really looking for are plants of interesting biodynamic properties that can be manipulated and developed by modern science. And so we always went to the rainforest, remembering that adage of Paracelsus, so that invariably brought our attention as botanical explorers to any plant that showed promise pharmacologically. And so naturally we were drawn to toxic plants, we're drawn to medicinal plants, and we were invariably drawn to the realm of the shaman and these so-called hallucinogenic plants. And we were drawn there for a couple of different reasons. First of all, you couldn't possibly begin to understand or distinguish a plant that might have real pharmaceutical potential from a plant that was simply the support of a cultural idea or the support of sympathetic magic if you didn't understand something about the culture. And so in entering the realm of the shaman, you had to really come to understand, of course, a very different notion of the nature of disease, a different notion of the nature of healing. And in our society, of course, we distinguish the priest from the physician and delegate to the priest realms of the spirit, and we delegate to the physician realm, the physical realm of the body. In most of these traditional cultures, priest and physician are one, because the state of the body is seen as being as important as the state of the spirit and vice versa. And so the shaman really can treat disease at two very different levels. On the one hand, he or she can treat diseases symptomatically, much as we would do in allopathic medicine, only in place of medicinal drugs, they use medicinal plants, many of which, as I've suggested, are both pharmacologically active and the source of many of our modern drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But critically, that kind of physical treatment of disease is somewhat mundane, because really to get to the source of a problem or a dilemma, you have to get into the spirit realm, and for that the shaman must, you know, invoke some technique of ecstasy that gets him away on the wings of trance into those realms. And that accounts for the curious discovery of these interesting entheogenic or hallucinogenic preparations. Now, one of the fascinating things in the entire history of ethnobotany is the fact that of the roughly 120 so-called hallucinogenic plants known from nature, probably 90% are from the Americas, not because the forests of equatorial West Africa or Southeast Asia are lacking in these interesting plants with biodynamic properties, but rather because the use of these plants is firmly rooted in culture. And, you know, as my studies in Haiti and in West Africa showed, that the people of African heritage have a different vehicle to the divine, and that, of course, is spirit possession and any number of other kind of esoteric practices of that great tradition. But in the Americas, the quintessential route to the divine, if you will, is the magic plant, whether that's peyote in the American Southwest and in Mexico, or the psilocybin mushrooms in Mexico, or whether it's ayahuasca in the Amazon. And the reason we're interested in these preparations, A, is for medical research, B, is because of their properties are so extraordinarily dazzling, but more importantly, they have a tremendous role to play in culture, but even more importantly, they tell us something very profound about a different way of knowing. The classic example would be ayahuasca, you know, and I think it's worth commenting on that, because ayahuasca, which has gotten some notoriety in North America and Europe in recent years, technically is not really a plant as much as a preparation. It's a combination of plants. The name itself means the vision vine or vine of the soul, and it's the most important of the preparations of the shaman of the Northwest Amazon. But what's fascinating about it scientifically is that it's a combination of plants. On the one hand, you have the leaves of a nondescript shrub in the coffee family, which are full of the compounds, tryptamines, dimethyltryptamine, 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine. These are powerfully psychoactive agents, but these agents are not orally active. You cannot take them through the mouth. You'll have no effect, because those compounds are naturally denatured by an enzyme found in the human stomach, which happens to be called monoamine oxidase.
Okay.
Now, they can only be taken orally if taken in conjunction with some other compound that denatures that enzyme in the human stomach. Now, it turns out that the second constituent in the ayahuasca preparation, which is a nondescript woody vine called Banisteriopsis caapi, series of beta-carbolines, harmine and harmaline and other compounds in it, which are MAO inhibitors of the precise sort necessary to potentiate the tryptamines found in the leaves of the shrub. Now, no one has to worry about the chemistry or even how it works, but
right.
Here's the interesting question. How, in a flora of 80,000 species of vascular plants...
Yeah, does one even find these?
How do you find them? How do you learn to combine them in these combinations? Now, the only scientific explanation is sort of trial and error, you know, which is quickly sort of exposed as a meaningless euphemism. And you ask the Indians, and they say, well, the plants teach us. And I think whatever that means, it suggests perhaps a different way of knowing. And this is not something that I'm indulging as kind of like a hippie ethnographer or a child of the New Age movement. I mean,
right.
A really different way of knowing. I mean, one of the great, I think, revelations of anthropology and what I really try to emphasize in my work, and in a sense on my crusade, if you will, or my mission at the National Geographic, is that one of the great revelations of our time has come from biology and from genetics. And that's the revelation, of course, that the human genome studies have given us. And it's proven without any doubt that all human beings are essentially cut from the same genetic cloth. We all are descended, you know, from roughly 1,000 people who walked out of Africa 55,000 years ago. In other words, we are all truly brothers and sisters in that sense. Now, if you accept that we're all essentially share the same genetic capacity or potential, then the corollary of that is that how people choose to use that potential is just simply a matter of choice and cultural orientation. Now, that seems obvious to us, but it hasn't always been so obvious. And in fact, much of the last century and the century before, the 19th and 20th century, was built on this idea that there was a progression in the affairs of human beings, that there were you know, primitive cultures and modern cultures, that there was a ladder of success that invariably placed European society at the top, or a pyramid that had Victorian England at the apex, and the pyramid went down to the so-called primitives of the world. Well, science has proven this to be simply a kind of ethnocentric conceit. The truth is that we have this idea in the West that while we've been developing our technological wizardry, which has been the great achievement of the West, and it's a fantastic thing. I mean, believe me, I'm not trying to in any way be critical of my own heritage. I mean, if I rip my arm off in a car accident, I don't want to be taken to an herbalist.
No, of course
but,
not.
But my point is that is just because we are wondrous doesn't mean these other peoples aren't also wondrous. And what you realize is that, okay, we've put all this incredible human potential into technological innovation, but the other people of the world haven't been intellectually or socially or spiritually idle. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I made a film once for the Geographic, which we called The Buddhist Science of the Mind, we used that term science of the mind, because after all, what is science but the pursuit of the truth? What is Buddhism but 2,500 years of empirical observation as to the nature of mind? You know, a Buddhist monk once said to me, you know, we in Tibet don't really believe that you went to the moon, but you did. You may not believe that we achieve enlightenment in one lifetime, but we do. In other words, different cultural choices make for different outcomes, and
right.
Those outcomes become our kind of collective heritage.
Absolutely. Well said. That's exactly what it is. I suppose I remember a philosophy professor I had once said something as far as perception is one's own individual reality, because we perceive things to be a certain way in the West, like you say, with modern technology and the Internet and Blackberries and pagers, etc., doesn't mean that our perception of reality is any more valid than, the Aboriginal peoples of Australia and Oceania.
Well, not at all. And in fact, the fascinating thing is that if you look, for example, at modernity as we know it, it's given us tremendous gifts,
mm-hmm.
but it's also brought us some peril. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, if the human species, we probably descended from our progenitor Homo erectus about 150,000 years ago, the Neolithic Revolution that gave us agriculture, at which time we sort of, you know, settled down and succumbed to the cult of the seed, if you will, was only 10,000 years ago. And modern industrial society, as we know it, is scarcely 300 years old. So in that time, we've achieved great wonders. But it's also a very shallow history, and it shouldn't suggest that we necessarily have all of the answers for all of the problems.
Absolutely. Now, something I wanted to touch on, Wade, just because it's relevant, I think, to, like you say, cultural differences, and from what I've read of your work, the tremendous cultural differences in the various parts of the world. I'm sure a lot of the people that are listening right now, when you touched on earlier your work in Haiti and the study of zombification, I think a lot of people are probably asking themselves, you know, did I hear that correctly, zombies? Are we being serious here?
Well, you know what happened is, you know, August, it was just an assignment that came out of the blue from my great professor at Harvard. And what had happened is that, you know, the zombie by folk belief is a living dead. It's an individual who's been brought to their demise by sorcery and then somehow cast into a state of perpetual purgatory, and that somehow involves enslavement and so on and so forth. Clearly kind of a scenario out of the phantasmagoric. But on the other hand, there were, in the Haitian literature and in folklore and reports of missionaries and scholars, there were a series of instances of people who seemed to have been diagnosed dead only to turn back up in the realm of living. And in the early 1980s, a team of very prominent physicians and psychopharmacologists, psychopharmacology is just the study of the action of drugs on the brain, including Nathan Klein, who is a legendary psychopharmacologist, and in fact, a man who loved Haiti and had set up the Psychiatric Institute there in Port-au-Prince in the capital city, an institute that bears his name. A close colleague of his from McGill University had a former student, Lamarck Douillon, who was the head of the Psychiatric Institute, and Douillon was fascinated by these folkloric reports of the zombie, and he, as a Haitian, had heard other reports of the reputed existence of folk poison that was said to bring on a state of apparent death so profound that it could fool a Western-trained physician. Now, were such a drug to exist, and its existence was specifically referred to in the penal code of the country, there was potential medical utility to the drug. That's at least what Klein thought. And so he, in 1982, asked me to go down to Haiti, not to find really a drug that's used to make zombies, but to see if I, because no drug can make a social phenomenon, but to go down and see if there could be folk preparation that had compounds in it that could make someone appear to be dead in such a way it would fool a physician. And that was really my assignment. And, of course, the first thing I had to do was look at the voodoo religion in general, and I came, of course, to realize that it was no black magic cult. It was just a complex metaphysical worldview. It was just one of the great religions of the human imagination. And, you know, if I ask you to name the great religions of the world, for some reason, well, actually, I know the reason, racism, really. You know, Africa's always left out. You know, what do we say? Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, whatever. There's always one continent left out. And voodoo is not a black magic cult. It's simply the distillation of very profound ideas that came over from Africa during the slavery era, came sown in the fertile soil of the New World. So, you know, the entire quest for the formula of that folk preparation and an understanding of the place that this idea of zombification might have in the Haitian world, and perhaps the world of West Africa, all of that was part of a kind of a sincere attempt to separate, make sense out of sensation, and sort of to take this phenomenon that had been used in bad Hollywood movies and pulp fiction and try to show that it had some kind of logic to it.
Yeah, and I think that's important, Wade, because I just wanted the listeners to understand, too, that what you had studied obviously wasn't the sort of zombies in the Lucio Fulci or George A. Romero sense.
No, I mean, the fear in Haiti is not of zombies, as bad movies would imply, but the fear is of becoming a zombie, because as a concept, as a notion, zombification, at least I concluded, was a form of social sanction.
Ostracism.
Invoked an ostracism invoked by recognizable, powerful executive groups, and or at least symbolic groups, perhaps, but certainly the secret societies that seemed to be a very powerful political force in rural Haiti for all kinds of historical reasons. We could trace origins right back to Africa. And so really, that's really what I was trying to do with that. And the idea we have of voodoo being evil or zombies crawling out of the grave to attack people, I mean, it's interesting. That idea really originated during the 1920s when the U.S. Marine Corps occupied Haiti and everybody above the rank of sergeant got a book contract. And those books had names like Black Baghdad, Voodoo Fire in Haiti, Cannibal Cousins, Puritan, and Voodoo. There were dozens of these books. It gave rise to the RKO movies. And they essentially said to the American people, any place where such abominations could occur, it could only find its redemption in military occupation.
Well, exactly, and avoid that place at all costs kind of thing.
Right.
Your work in Haiti eventually led to your best-selling book, The Serpent and the Rainbow, which I've read, and it's a fantastic book for those that are interested. Of course, that also led to a major motion picture of the same name. It's my understanding that you're not a big fan of the work itself.
Well, I think the movie was a real disappointment, and it was a lost opportunity. You know, I mean, I think it was Hemingway said, if you sell a book to Hollywood, you should start off in Arizona, drive to the California state line, throw the book over, and go back to Tucson and have a drink. I mean, you know, it was unfortunate that the project was sort of hijacked in a certain way, as often happens in Hollywood, and ended up in the hands of people, not the original producer, my friend David Ladd, but, you know, it just ended up sort of in the hands of people at the studios who said, what are you talking about, zombies, voodoo, magic, come on, this is a horror movie. So instead of directed by Peter Weir and who they had promised me, that it ended up in the hands of quite a nice man, but a man of makes horror films, Wes Craven. But, you know, I mean, again, you know, to quote another famous character, you know, William Faulkner said when he was asked what he thought of what Hollywood did to his books, you know, he pointed to his bookshelf and he said, they didn't do anything to my books, they're my books. And the movie's kind of, you know, has its own kind of following, but the book still exists and is, you know, has a kind of following and sells quite well. And you know, and it still remains a powerful and sincere statement about the wonder of Haitian culture.
Absolutely. Hear, hear. Once again, folks, Dr. Wade Davis, it was a pleasure, Wade. I appreciate you making time for the show.
You bet. Take care, August.
So, Barb, what do you think? Dr. Wade Davis, talk about a Renaissance man.
He's certainly very accomplished.
And it's good to see that Canadians abroad are still endeavoring to do noble deeds. Ladies and gentlemen, we are all out of time for this episode of Full Frontal right here on CHRW 94.9 FM. If you don't like kicking it old school via radio, you can also catch us on channel 943 with Rogers Digital Cable or online anywhere in the world at chrwradio.com every other Monday at 6:30 a.m. and again at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Until then, if you have any questions for myself, for Barb, or a guest, past or present, email me at august@chrwradio.com or visit me online at www.augustdonnelly.com. Tune in next time. You just might learn something.